So you're listening to DNA Today, where we discover new advances in the world of genetics. I'd like to introduce and thank Dr. Jonathan Klassen for being on the program here today. Welcome.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be.
And we're recording in your lab, which is pretty cool. I got to see the ants and everything and the work you're doing, so we'll get into all of that. Before we do, I do want to introduce you and your background and everything that you've come from. Dr. Klassen is an assistant professor here at UConn. He receives his PhD in microbiology and biotechnology at the University of Alberta, and your postdoctoral study was in the Department of Bacteriology at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. And you have your own lab here on campus that we mentioned, and you presented to my microbio class about your research with fungus growing ants and ant symbiosis to understand how microbial interaction evolves. So we'll get into that and what you're doing in genetics and what classes you're teaching and kind of just a little insight of what you do every day.
Sounds great.
So can you start out by telling us a little about your current research?
Sure. So my lab is, we're fascinated by the fact that there are tons of microbes everywhere, right? And for the most part, we don't know how they're meeting and greeting each other, how they're affecting each other, right? So on the human body, for instance, there are somewhere on the order between 3 to 10 times more microbes than there are human cells, right? There are 100 times more genes than human genes, right? But all those microbes are trying to reproduce and make more of themselves, right? So how does that work? How does all those interactions trying to reproduce themselves, how does that affect the fitness of their host? So humans are complicated, and we don't study those per se, but we use a simplified model of these ants that have a really interesting lifestyle. They're farmers. They grow a fungus that's their food source, and so it's a reduced complexity situation where we can sort of pick it apart and figure out who's there, what are they doing, who's talking to who, and how does that change over space and time, and how does that really ultimately impact the host. And we're trying to find general rules that we can scale up and figure out how that works for humans, say, or agriculture, or something that's more complicated and more difficult to study at the conceptual level.
So what are the key players? Who are the key roles in what you're studying? You're studying the ants, the fungus. Who else is involved?
Right. So we have the ants. The ants that we study, they'll cut leaves, seeds, insect feces, things like that. They'll gather them all together. They'll take them down into their colony, and they'll feed them to what we call the cultivar fungus. It's the good guy. And they will wrap the fungal threads, the mycelia, around all of those food particles. The fungus will break it down, and it'll grow. And then in return, the fungus will make these swellings on the end of all of those mycelial threads, and the ants will collect those and eat them. So that's how the ants get their food. Now, a sort of problem with that sort of symbiosis means to a couple of organisms that are living together, right? And then in that case, they're really tightly locked in together, right? If the fungus needs the ants to live, the ants need the fungus to live. So it's two parts there, right? Problem with that is that if one of those gets sick, the other one dies, and it turns out that happens quite often. So there are other bad guy fungi that come in, and they'll try to kill the good guy fungus, the cultivar, and so that's a big problem for the ants. And so now we have three different players in the system. There's the ants, there's the good guy fungus, there's the bad guy fungus. And so the ants do lots of things to protect against the bad guys, but one of the things they do is that they have a bacterium that they keep on their bodies. It's this thing called pseudocardia. And what that bacterium does is that it makes antibiotics that can protect the good guy fungus against the bad guy fungus. So now we have four different players in there, right? We have the ants, we have the good guy fungus, we have the bad guy fungus, and then we have good guy bacteria that kill the bad guy fungus. And then we know there's a few other things as well, so that we know that in some cases there's a fungus that tries to eat the good guy bacteria. We know that there's other bacteria that live with the good guy fungus, and they provide nitrogen in some cases, so that they act like a fertilizer. But so you see there's this complicated web of things that are going on. So it's realistic. It's not just a sort of one-to-one sort of thing that doesn't happen anywhere else. But there's not a ton of them. So in total, we think right now there's about 20 different players in this symbiosis all together. We can take those apart and put them back together and do all sorts of experiments on them.
I'm sure that gets very complicated, keeping track of 20 different roles and how they're all interacting.
Oh, sure.
So you take one out and see how the rest are affecting or how they're affected by the absence of one, things like that?
Yeah, absolutely. And so one of the nice things about working with these microbes is that we can grow them nicely on petri dishes. And so we can take one out all by itself and say, well, how does it grow? And then we can put another one in there and say, well, how does that change how it grows when there's two together? And so taking this sort of really reductionist sort of approach, we can basically make a network where the dots are all the organisms, and we can draw lines between them that are good or bad, and build it up from one at a time, two at a time. And eventually where we want to go with this is starting from all these pure building blocks, right, putting them together and making something that looks like the natural community. So it's got one good guy fungus and five good guy bacteria, and that will protect against the bad guy fungus, and the ants will take it. And maybe we can build this from the bottom up. Synthetic ecology is what we like to think we're going to end up doing. So that's in the future, but
definitely. So you go to sites where this is natural in the environment and bring it back to your lab.
Yes, absolutely. So the ant species that I work on in particular is called Trichomyrmex septentrionalis. It's a relatively poorly studied fungus-growing ant. The real sort of stars of fungus-growing ant research are the leafcutters that you see on David Attenborough and all this sort of thing, the ones who carry the leaves on their heads and take them back to their nest. And they can get huge, millions and millions of ants, up to sort of 5 to 8 million ants in a colony.
You showed pictures, like during the presentation you did, of just how massive these structures are.
Oh, yeah, about the size of a two-car garage. And what's crazy about those is that there's one queen that does the whole thing, right? So she shows.
So one queen for millions of ants.
Millions of ants.
That's some power right there.
they've been a model system, those, for social biology and complexity and behavior for about the last 100 years, because people are so fascinated by these dynamics. So those are mostly in Central and South America. There's some of them that come up into Texas, a few more into Arizona. We don't study those ones as much. We study sort of the evolutionarily more distant cousins, and we do that for a few reasons. They're a lot smaller, they're easier to collect, and they are practically closer to us. So the species we study ranges all throughout the eastern U.S. In sort of pine oak savanna type forests. So Long Island's as far north as they go in the Pine Barrens. We spend a lot of time in the New Jersey Pine Barrens, and we go all the way down the coast, so all the way down to Florida, and we're doing some work in Georgia and North Carolina this year as well. And they move further west as well, as far west as Texas and Illinois. But we haven't studied those populations yet. So one of the interesting things about that gradient is that it gets colder as you go further north. So that's one thing that we think is changing how the microbes interact with each other. How do they all individually adapt to changing temperature? And we can look at across that gradient. And when we get down to mechanisms and the genomes and things like that, we can see how things are changing. We certainly see the pathogens that are present change across that gradient. So how does that affect the antibiotics that are needed? If you have a different bad guy, can you use different drugs effectively to protect? So that's our design.
So what other factors other than location are affecting the diversity of ants that you're studying?
Yeah, we don't really know. It's likely that what microbes are present, so the pathogens, but also the other ones, it's possible that in some places there are other species of fungus-growing ant that they might switch pathogens with. That's probably only true in the sort of far west and far south of the range that we're talking about. But definitely temperature is the one that's been shown to be a driver. And there are climactic correlates, so things like humidity, say, and that sort of thing. And then there's probably differences in the nutrients that the ants are able to collect as well. The pine forest species will change along that gradient, but we don't really know what effect that has. We think that it probably does something. We haven't done those experiments yet.
So for these ants, do their genetics differ because they're different species, or how does that work?
Sure, that's a great question. So yes, different species are different genetically. And we don't have a huge handle on that yet, because there's only been a couple, I guess three fungus-growing ant genomes that have been published to this point. And ant genomes are tough to work with because they're very large. I'm a microbiologist. My definition of large is kind of warped.
I was going to say, how do they compare to humans? Or
sure, I mean, and they're on the similar order of magnitude
as
humans. And so with the genome sequencing technology, that becomes expensive. We've done a lot of genomics work with the microbes, which are much more cost-effective to sequence their genomes. We're at the point where we can do a microbial genome for on the order of $100, $200. So we do a lot of genome sequencing of the microbes themselves. And what we see when we do that, you asked the question about between species. We actually tend to look within species for differences. And what we see is that even at those more recent evolutionary times, that there are differences between ants living in different places and the microbial symbionts of the ants living in different places. And that's actually an interesting part of the symbiosis in our mind, because the way the ant life cycle works is that when the colonies get big enough and they're going to make new colonies, the queen has been in there the whole time laying eggs that turn into new ants. And they're all sterile workers up until the colony gets a certain size, and then she makes the sexual form of the ant. So virgin males, virgin females, they fly off and mate, and they go found new colonies. The virgin queens, before they leave the nest, they take a little bit of the fungus garden, and they put it in a little pouch underneath their chin to anthropomorphize, and then they fly off with it, and they mate, and then they will land and they'll dig a new colony hole, and they'll regurgitate that bit of fungus garden, and they'll start a new colony from that. And so what that means is that the lifestyle of the microbes that are symbionts are really closely linked to the lifestyle of the ants. As the ant goes, so does the microbes go. And so we can see that the ants, they don't tend to fly very far. It's been estimated on the order of about 100 meters or so. And so you can imagine that that the ants in Florida, say, are not flying up to North Carolina or further north, even Jersey or the Long Island Pine Barrens, right? Those ants are not flying back and forth between there with great frequency. And so the microbes aren't switching back and forth. And so what happens is that the ones in Long Island become genetically distinct from the ones in Florida. And we can see that using DNA sequencing and phylogenetic analyses to track their evolution.
And so the ants are evolving with the fungus then, because they're symbiosis together.
Right. And in that case, they're co-evolving. So both sides are adapting to the other one. And we can see that with genomics.
So when you sequence genomes, how does that work? How do you use that data and analyze that?
Sure. So we use it a number of different ways. The first one is what I talked about, is just comparing the sequences using phylogenetics. And what that means is that we're basically taking the strings of letters and comparing them using, you can think of DNA as strings of letters, right? And we can apply algorithms that model, well, if those if there are two sequences and they had a common ancestor, and then over time they evolved, what would that evolution look like? And we can use that to sort of look backwards in time and say, what were the ancestors like? Who were they most related to? How long ago did they split apart? Those sorts of questions. That's how the basics of phylogenetics. And so we use those techniques a lot. We can, using related techniques, we can also see who is exchanging DNA with whom, right? So in the animals that are sexual, what ants are recombining with others, right? Who's mating with who, right? And their DNA gets shuffled together. Bacteria are a little bit crazier in how they shuffle DNA around, but we can track that as well. And one of the interesting things about that, especially with the bacteria and the fungi as well in some cases, is that they tend to gain or lose different genes. And often the genes that they gain and lose will be genes that code for things that are important for a particular function in a particular place at a particular time. So the one that we're most interested in is antibiotic production, or antifungals, right? So the way we like to think of the model working is that, say there's some ants and all their microbes that are living in New Jersey, and a new pathogen comes in, and that pathogen will kill out all the ants that are there beforehand, because nobody's got resistance to the bad guy, right? And well, how does it overcome that? Well, it's got these bacteria that live on its body that produce antibiotics. If they can get a new bacteria that produces a new antibiotic, or if they can get genes that code for a new antibiotic that'll kill that new one, then that will allow them to persist in the environment. And that's how the evolution works, right? Is that there are these repeated cycles of some new pathogen coming in, that the ants will get new antibiotics or tweak old ones that they have, perhaps, and be able to combat the new one. And there's lots of complexities to that. It's not as simple as that story. But that's how we think of it, is trying to track how antibiotics are working in the wild, right? Responding to new pathogens come in and combating them, and the pathogens evolving resistance, just like we see in human disease as well. So it's a model that way as well.
And so you're able to use a lot of this information to then look at how humans are also related to this or affected by this in terms of antibiotics, like maybe in healthcare?
Yeah, sure. So it's actually really surprising that we know almost nothing about how antibiotics actually work in the wild, right? I mean,
yeah.
You think about how antibiotics were discovered, right?
When I hear antibiotics, as, you know, a naive student, I think of just, okay, the pills your doctor gives you when you have bacterial infection.
Sure, and how were they originally discovered, right? You have Fleming in his lab in the 20s,
mm-hmm.
right? It's a contaminant in his petri dishes that didn't clean well before he went on holidays, and now he discovered something that kills something else, right? You have all of the Selman Waksman in the 40s, right? A real pioneer in this. They just go out and find some dirt and swoosh it around, and they'd isolate something, and it happens to kill everything, and oh, I happen to discover streptomycin, and that's great for humanity, right? And it gets scaled up, but we have no idea what it was doing in that dirt that it came from, right? And even after now almost 100 years, right, 90 years, we still don't really understand how that works. And so using this symbiosis research that we do, we're able to track those for really one of the very few examples where we can look at these sorts of things.
Definitely. So you've done a lot of kind of, you have a lot of experience in researching with genetics and everything. What are other projects that you've done that have related to genetics other than just looking at ants' genetics with other symbiosis with other things?
Sure. So my postdoctoral research was working on the ants, but also as well we were very interested in just the idea that we can find new antibiotics potentially by looking at genome sequences. And so we were looking at the ants, but also a whole bunch of different bacteria that we isolated from insects. And the rationale there was that these microbes might be doing something for the insect, or, I mean, there's an ecological basis for them to produce antibiotics as a means to kill bad guys or help good guys or something like that. And so we did a lot of genome sequencing, and this is especially in collaboration with the Joint Genome Institute, which my lab continues to collaborate with. They're interested in how these signaling molecules work to promote turning plants into energy, essentially. And that's essentially what our ants do, right, with their microbes. So the JGI, they sequenced a large number of bacterial genomes, and many other people have sequenced bacterial genomes and put them in public databases. And so I was developing algorithms to compare genes that look like they might encode an antibiotic and try to answer the question, are they going to produce something that's structurally new we haven't seen before, or how do we tell if these things are related? And we're not quite at the goal for that yet, but that's certainly something that we're looking at. It turns out antibiotics are very interesting because in a lot of cases you can look at the genome sequence and there are algorithms out there that will predict the functions of the particularly relevant proteins. And then you can predict to a large extent the chemistry that's going to happen during the biosynthesis of the antibiotic. And so we can go from sequence to chemical structure with some degree of accuracy. And so I collaborate a lot with natural product chemists who are interested in actually solving the chemical structure. We're interested in from the genome side, and we end up going back and forth, and it becomes very complementary. The one says, oh, I see this. Oh, that explains something that I see. Oh, I see this. Oh, that explains something I see, right? So both sides can work back and forth, and so the genomes help solve the structure helps interpret the genomes. We did a lot of that work. The other work that I was very involved in during that time was more of a technology-based one, and so sort of take a few steps back. Genome sequencing used to be really expensive, right?
Very much so, yes.
I mean, I said a couple hundred bucks to do a bacterial genome. That's a new phenomenon.
And it's rapidly declining, the price.
Oh, yeah. Just... Oh, yeah, hugely so. And so, but what happened, so when the human genome was sequenced, all those technologies, so this is now 10 years ago, right? The technology they were using basically made what we call long-length reads, or at the time we called them that. And one way to think of this is that the way the experiment works is you take the genome, you can think of it as a picture, right? And then you bust it up into a whole bunch of pieces. And you can think of it like taking a picture, putting it on some cardboard, and making a jigsaw puzzle out of it, right? So, yeah, cutting it all out, right? And then shuffling up all the pieces, right, in the box, and that's what happens on the DNA sequencer. You can only sequence one piece at a time.
You can't just put it through and just sequence. Not that.
Yeah, it's not a you read the whole thing, right? It doesn't work like that.
Not a ticker tape, yeah.
But we're getting there. We can circle back to that if you want. And so on the computer afterwards, the challenge is putting the jigsaw puzzles back together, right? And so when the technology that the Human Genome Project was using, you can think of it as a 100-piece jigsaw puzzle, right? So relatively easy to do, right? You can see what's going on because the pieces are big, right? That's an easier puzzle to do.
It's not the 1,000-piece jigsaw puzzle anymore. Now it's the 100.
Right, exactly. Now, when about 2005 was the first of what they called the next generation, which is an absurd name because now we're what happens after the next generation? We're right
the
now.
Following
so
generation.
We'll leave that aside. But is the Roche 454 instrument, and what it did is that it sequenced DNA orders of magnitudes cheaper than the Sanger instruments could, right? And that's what was used to make the 100-piece puzzle, right? The problem was that the pieces were now about a tenth of the size as what the old technology could do. So it made a truckload more of them, but now instead of a 100-piece puzzle, now we're trying to do a 10,000-piece puzzle. Right.
So in some terms it's easier, but then when you go to put it back together, it's a lot harder.
Right. So it became easier in that we could access genome information much more cost effectively. We could do it faster, all these sorts of things. It became harder because, to use the puzzle analogy, right, think of doing the sky part of the puzzle. Right. It's always lousy, right? Because you're like, oh, it all looks exactly the same.
You get lucky if there's a cloud, but other than that.
Right, exactly, right? And the computers have the exact same problem, right? Because there's parts of the genome, especially that are highly repetitive, that are the exact same sequence over and over again.
Because there's only four letters, so it is repetitive.
Right, exactly. And there are structures like transposons or things like that that are present in many, many copies, right? And so what the computer says is it's got two puzzle pieces, and like, oh, does it go over here or does it go over here? I can't tell because it all looks like sky, right? And what happens then is that it doesn't actually finish putting the puzzle together, right? All it does is it puts the parts that it can put together, and those typically are the genes, so it's really useful. But the stuff in between gets lost, and so what happens is the quality of the sequence went down a whole lot. And this is still true today in many cases. And so during my postdoc, we spent a lot of time saying, well, what can we do with these lower quality sequences? And it turns out you can do an awful lot, especially those phylogenetic things. You can still do a lot with low-quality draft sequences. But one of the things that was unfortunate is that the antibiotic biosynthetic proteins, the ones that we were super interested in, they happen to have this repeating structure. And so it turned out that they were one of the lousiest things to be assembled properly. So the things that we were looking for and devoting all these experiments targeting turned out to be the worst for these new technologies. So we've actually shifted into different technologies that are a little bit more expensive, but give much longer reads and allow those things to be put together. So we're doing some using a technology called Pacific Biosciences. They produce less sequence data, but the sequence data that they do is in now 15,000 base pair chunks, right? And so that covers a whole gene or most of it, right? And it's much easier to put together. There are issues with those data as well. One of the exciting things in my lab is that we've got the Oxford Nanopore technology, which is basically, it's the size of, it's as long as my finger is. And we plug it into the computer here, and we stick a little bit of sample in the top, and it's a microfluidics chip, basically, and this thing will read DNA, and it's been reported to have enormously long read lengths. And this will go and read a genome, at least the size of a bacteriophage at this point, so a virus that infects bacteria.
So how much does something like that cost? It's very tiny.
It's incredibly tiny. It's a pre-access program, so we're beta testing this right now. The company has made it available for a $1,000 deposit and then $250 to do the shipping costs.
So much less than I would anticipate.
Oh yeah, that's
only
yeah,
1,000.
So I think that's what they're trying to make with their right? Because the PacBio instrument that I talked about before that does something similar with a long reads costs hundreds of thousands of dollars to get one, right? So we don't have one on campus here. It's basically the only instrument we don't have. But this allows individual researchers now to have their own genome sequencer in their lab. And so there's a lot of people all around the world who are doing this beta testing, and those results are just starting to come out, and they're very promising. There's still issues, but the company is improving orders of magnitude sort of with each release of the chip. They send us new updates to this, new updates to their software, and it's improving markedly as it goes along.
And you're able to use this with just the computer you have in your office?
Yep, yeah, it plugs in right here beside me.
Wow, that's impressive. So you're also teaching microbial genomics course next semester, in the fall semester. What is microbial genomics? What can students expect if they take your class?
Right, sure. So the course, we ran the course last year for the first time, and it's really based on the idea that genomics is revolutionizing microbiology and all the stuff we've talked about, right? There are now tens of thousands of microbial genomes out there. If it's costing you $150 to sequence your genome, well, it's becoming to the point where that's the first thing you do when you get a microbe, right? Well, let's sequence its genome and see what it might be able to do, right? So that's a paradigm shift. That's revolutionary. The problem with that is that happens over and over again. I get people come to me all the time, and this sort of thing. Well, we got these genomes, and it made this huge data file, right? And I mean, these are gigabytes in size, right? And now what do I do with it, right? And it's really answering that question that the course is trying to do. And I mentioned the file size. That's one problem, is that we're past the point where you can open up the data in Excel or Word or something, right? It'll crash all of those programs every time. And so the way that we interact with and use the computer has to change a little bit. And so it's moving a little bit more in the direction of computer science and scripting and these sorts of things, but it's also very similar to how I started to learn to use a computer, using DOS back in the day, right? So the objective of the course is sort of twofold. One is to show people what data look like and what they can do with it to get a genome from this giant data file, right? But the second thing is to take biologists, so these are typically people who don't have a lot of experience working at this level with the computer and that sort of thing, and to just show them really basic intro stuff. This is how you can move a file that big around, right? This is how you can access the computing servers that we have on campus here, which are available to UConn students and faculty and staff, right? You can get an account, have your data there, and you can run these computationally intensive analyses using those resources, but you have to know how to connect, right? And a lot of that is typing words onto a screen, right? It's not point and click like Windows or Mac OS or whatever, right? Mm-hmm. And so it's getting down to that level. And then we teach a little, just very basic, how to do a little bit of computer coding that you can more powerfully analyze those data, right? So I said that you can't open most of these data in Excel, right? So what tends to happen is you'll run some analysis, it'll produce this table that's enormous, right? Well, you can't open it in Excel. Well, what do you do with it then? And so there are ways, using really quite simple techniques, that you can extract those data and play with them. And so it's trying to introduce these sorts of ideas to biologists who are going to need to have a little bit of this computational experience to be able to access the revolution that's actually happening in microbiology through all of these huge improvements in genomics.
That's fantastic that students are able to get exposure to this as undergrads.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And, I mean, the whole thing is run basically, it's not formally a lab course, but practically that's what it is. Everybody brings in their laptop, and we sit around a table in the room.
Very hands-on.
Very hands-on, and I walk around, help people, and, I mean, there's little talking, there's lots of doing. So I think it's a great course. The feedback's been very good so far. So I'd encourage if your listeners are out there and thinking, oh, I'd love to get in on that, check us out. There's still open slots. I'd love to have you.
And that's MCB3895.
That's right.
All right. Definitely look on that on Student Admin. And thank you so much for being on the program. It's fantastic to hear everything that's going on here. Listeners, you can find out more information on JonathanKlassenLab.com. You can also follow on Twitter at KlassenLab and also the show at DNA Podcasts. Thanks for tuning in to DNA Today every Monday, 11:30 a.m. on WHUS.org or 91.7 to learn new advances in the world of genetics.